This is Comic Shenanigans, episode 1012, a conversation with Mark Bernardo. Hey, no stopping them shenanigans. Logging into shenanigans. All up in them shenanigans. Welcome to the Comic Shenanigans podcast. I'm your host, Adam Chapman. This is episode 1012. It's our conversation with Mark Bernardo. Mark Bernardo worked for Marvel Comics back during the 90s. So we had a really fun conversation kind of talking about what it was like to work at Marvel in the 90s. I'm always fascinated by that time period. It's the time period when I first started reading comics. So I'm always very partial to the creators and editors and everyone who worked at Marvel at that time and finding out more stories about what that was like. And Mark was definitely one of the kind of jack of all trades at the period, because he was editing, he was writing, he was coloring, he did it all. And on this episode, we actually talk a lot about it, and it was honestly a lot of fun. Again, filling in the blanks on some of the Spider-Man Clone Saga era editorial is always very interesting to find out more about. So this was quite a good deep dive into that period. If you want to email me, you can email me at comicshenanigans@gmail.com. Rate the show on iTunes, subscribe to us on iTunes, and listen to us on Spotify. And without further ado, let's jump right into the conversation with Mark Bernardo. Enjoy. Mark, welcome to the Comic Shenanigans podcast. How are you today?
I'm good, Adam. How are you?
I'm good. I'm always excited to talk to anyone who worked at Marvel in the 90s. I find it one of the most fascinating periods, and it's when I became a comic book fan. So I'm really excited that you were, willing to take part in this. But before, I guess, we jump into how you ended up at Marvel, how did you become a comic book fan to begin with?
I guess it was probably a combination of reruns of the old 60s Batman TV show at first, followed by reruns of the very limited animation 60s Marvel cartoons after that, which really kind of gave me an appreciation of Stan and Jack and Steve and all that, just that whole universe they created. And again, despite the, I didn't even care how terrible the animation was, it was just the characters were so awesome. I still, despite the fact that all these characters have now been in movies, if I read a Thor comic, I'm still hearing that voice from the cartoons. If I read Iron Man, I'm still hearing, John Vernon with the tin can over his mouth or whatever. And they were that influential for me. So I guess it just kind of blossomed from there.
Now, when you first start kind of reading the actual comics, so you see it, and it's in the ether, it's in this other media. What are the first comics that you're reading?
The first comic that I remember actually coming into the house was a Marvel Planet of the Apes comic that my dad brought home. My dad used to bring comics home for me and my brother and sisters to read. It was a while before I went ahead and started buying them for myself, but that was kind of where it started. Obviously, there was no real... My dad wasn't a collector, just picked up whatever, looked interesting. So it was just kind of a mishmash of things, Planet of the Apes and some Batman and some Spider-Man. And I guess what really hooked me, that kind of got me to say, okay, Dad, I want the next one of these, was a run of the Hulk in the... it must have been late 70s, early 80s. Around the 230s or something, the corporation storyline with Quasar and all that, if you remember any of that stuff. So that got me. And then what, from there, it's really kind of an odd way to get into it, but I so much liked the Quasar character in that storyline, who is just kind of a background character. Mm-hmm. But one of those footnotes said that, okay, you could follow him into Marvel 2-in-1 next month. And that was, of course, the start of the Project Pegasus saga, the six-part thing. And I'm like, oh, six six parts. I guess I have to get all of these. And it's Quasar, and it's a different, and then Deathlok, who I thought had the coolest name and the coolest look, but they killed him in that same issue, so I was very upset. But I just read all the way to the end of the Project Pegasus saga, and just kept going with Marvel 2 and 1 from there. I mean, John Byrne, George Perez, I learned my favorite artists really quickly, and it just kind of blossomed from there, because that book it was a team-up book, so it interacted with so much of the rest of Marvel that I had to, like, check out other things. And, I mean, just fast-forward several years, and I was just devouring everything, pretty much everything Marvel, writing and drawing my own little comics, as so many of us did. And at one point, realized it could be a career if I played my cards right and did the work and learned the right things. So that was kind of how it started.
Now, I'm going to jump ahead for a second, because I do want to kind of get into the entry into Marvel. But just in listening to that story and looking at some of the work you did while you were at Marvel, you really were a jack of all trades. Like, you were coloring, you wrote, even penciled an issue, or at least worked on pencils with a few others. So did you always kind of know that you were this jack of all trades, that you could do many different things that were going to be asked for of you? Or is that just because you were so excited to be in the industry and working on it, they were just like, I'll pitch in wherever I can?
I thank you for that description. I had never thought of it that way, but yeah, I guess I did. I just learned a few different things. Initially, what I wanted to do, like so many of it, I knew I wanted to write and draw. I wanted to be a writer artist, kind of. Again, I was inspired by guys like Byrne and Perez. And I took college courses accordingly. I got a commercial art degree. Most of my fellow students went into advertising. I knew I wanted to get into comics. But my entry into comics was a Marvel internship. And Marvel internships were generally in editorial offices. So what I had to do was show that I could do the editorial stuff, which at the time I barely knew what that was, except that I knew there were editors whose names I recognized on the books. I'm like, when you read like five books and realize, okay, this is different writers, artists, ever, but it's the same editor, You realize, okay, this guy's doing a good job, whoever he is or whatever he or she does. So I just kind of, from college, I jumped into the Marvel internship. I worked for an editor named Rob Tokar on, at the time it was, Transformers. They weren't the actually Transformers is probably more famous now than it was then, but it was kind of a lower tier book at the time. I worked on those the last years of that. I'm just really like paying my dues on books like Captain Planet and The Toxic Avenger and like that. Rob would joke about this too, I assure you. But yeah, and I found that I did have, I guess, both an aptitude and an appreciation for, finding talent, editing scripts, editing covers and the whole continuity and just the whole rigmarole of the day-to-day, the office, to get the pencils to the inker, get the inks to the letterer, and then get the, make the copies for the colorist and put it all together. I liked being in charge of the whole process. It's probably a cliche to say it feels like directing a movie, which I've never actually done, but that was kind of how it felt. So I enjoyed that, and that was kind of my career trajectory. But I still had the creative urge, so at the time, in the, as you know, Marvel put out a lot of books in the 90s, and there was a lot of rush coloring jobs that needed to be done. And not every editor could do that. Some of us did. Those of us with some artistic training did. So I just did a little of that on the side, and I wrote letters pages, and I obviously wanted to write things as well, but for some reason I just got so, I was so wrapped up in my day-to-day that it took me a while to really concentrate on that. But I try to develop these skills simultaneously and just, be useful and to be totally frank, to make money, to make, I was living in New York City. I didn't make a whole lot of money as an assistant editor at first. So, a lot of it was a financial need, but it sure was a fun way to make extra money.
So when you're kind of establishing yourself and you're working in editorial there at Marvel, this is going to maybe sound silly, but was there a goal in terms of like, I want to be in this editorial group, or was one editorial group seeming to be better in terms of a family of titles? Like, was that even an ethos that existed at the time, or was everyone just like, you're working on something? But as you said, like, you were kind of working on books that maybe we were considered lower tier when you first kind of got into it. So were you aware and cognizant of that at the time, and have a goal as to which editorial group you wanted to lean towards, if you had your druthers?
Yeah. I guess I can't really say that about myself. When I started out, I was in a position that was, we called it the editorial assistant. I literally was working for Mary McFerrin, who was the editor-in-chief, Tom DeFalco's assistant. So I was an assistant to an assistant. But even then, I had tons of stuff to do. I had lots of interaction with Tom DeFalco, and all the editors. I mean, I was kind of a go-between. I was kind of a liaison, in a way, between a lot of the editorial offices. So, you know, they all saw what I could do, how I could be efficient, how I could, think on my feet and everything. And it's just as an aside, it was in that job that I actually got to meet for the first time Stan Lee. Because Stan was in California even at the time, but he checked in with Tom DeFalco at times, and I picked up the phone sometimes and talked to him. And he also still wrote the Spider-Man newspaper strip, which was routed through our office and through Tom's editorial brothers. So that was kind of fun. I met a lot of really bold-faced names just in that really lower tier job. But anyway, to make a long story short, I was ready to go to basically any editor that would have me. And as it turned out, and Spider-Man, I've been a Spider-Man fan my entire life. So when it became that Danny Fingeroth, you know, picked me for that job, it was more than I could even imagine. So I embraced that role, and it was, as you I'm sure are aware, it became a very interesting period to be in the Spider-Man editorial team.
Absolutely. Now, when you're working, as you said, kind of assistant to the assistant at for Tom, I'm curious. I mean, I've talked with Tom before, but I'm talking with Tom many years removed from being editor-in-chief. What was it like working for Tom at the time? Obviously, there's a lot of stresses, especially at that time, especially obviously leading up to him, you know, not being the editor-in-chief anymore. So I'm just curious what it was like working that in such close proximity to him at that time.
Okay, well, I'm not sure I was clear. At the time, he was editor-in-chief.
Yes.
Yes, and again, I worked under him, and he was, again, I thought a really good guy to have in charge at the time, because he was a guy who understood the characters, and he also understood the business side. And he was good at dealing with all, because there was a lot of business side. I mean, Marvel was part of the problem, as it turned out in the 90s, was Marvel was growing very large from the top down. It's not like the editorial team wasn't also large at the time in the creative, but the company was expanding. There was the marketing department got huge, and the licensing, and we bought I forget the name of that trading card company. There was all these acquisitions.
Yeah,
Panini and the sticker and all that. So there was a whole lot more corporate people that were imposing, that, you know, wanted to impose their will on the, you know, the comics publishing, which, you know, to me is still the engine that drives everything. And Tom was very good at kind of shielding his editors from, you know, the direct influence of that. But, I mean, not entirely, because as we'll probably get into, the Spider-Man office in particular, I'm sure the X-Men office too, and various others, there was a lot of pressure on us to perform and to do so in ways that creatively we may not have agreed with.
I mean, it's not surprising as well. I mean, as you said, like in the early 90s period, I mean, you have DC kills off Superman. That becomes its own event. You have all these things happening. You have the Image Exodus. So all these things happen. And then you have Marvel obviously trying to keep up and keep going. And so it's not surprising that you have, you know, people in marketing being like, oh, this is really doing well. Do more of this. Do more of this now. Unfortunately, that runs counter to the creative process, which, you know, doesn't always, those two things don't always mesh, but it's hard to fault anyone for that. I mean, I will fault marketing people, but I won't fault anyone on the actual comic production side, because they were just at the whims of these, you know, some people who were not involved in creating the product.
I doubt I'm the first one to tell you this, but the whole Spider-Man clone saga was a more or less direct result of the Spider-Man office being told, you guys need to do a Death of Superman level event. So that was kind of our marching orders, and how we did that was, I mean, how we did, they didn't tell us exactly what to do, obviously, but how we did it was up to us, but that was kind of the pressure that we were all operating under at the time.
Not to mention
competing with the X-Men office, which was, you know, making way more money than everybody.
So I will always freely admit that I'm a huge fan of the Clone Saga. I grew up, again, kind of in that era, so I don't have any negative feelings about it. I enjoy it immensely and think it was a fun period in general, so I wasn't those people who, I guess, complained about the largesse as it kept going later on. But I'm curious, just working inside the machine, what were your original takes on it? Like, what did you think it was exciting? Because it seemed like, especially at the beginning, a great engine to drive stories. Like, you bring in a lot of stuff really quickly, new characters. You know, it definitely felt like a shot in the arm to the book. But how did you feel working behind the scenes?
Well, it would be very disingenuous of me to like criticize, you know, the overall ideas and the progression of the Clone Saga, because I was there for all of it. I mean, for whatever it's worth, I was the one editorial staffer, because there was so much turnover, as you know, because of the bankruptcies. I was the one editorial staffer who was there at the beginning and the end of the Clone Saga. So I literally saw everything. I think Howard Mackey on the creative side might have been the one guy who was also at the beginning and the end. So I was there for we had a conference where, again, we were given these marching orders about create this major event. And Danny Fingeroth was the Spider-Man editor. I worked for him. We had various, you know, creative people, really good creative people. And without getting into, I mean, we'd be here for 3 hours and we could do all the details of it. But we went in with one idea. Essentially, Danny had this overall arc that he wanted to do, and the writers, as I recall, were lukewarm on it. And they said, let's do something else. And I believe it was Terry Kavanaugh who had this idea that he had thought about for a long time. He was like, oh, what about that one scene in Amazing Spider-Man, whatever issue it was, where the Spider-Man dumped a clone down the smokestack? And he'd always thought, what if the wrong guy got dumped on the smokestack? And he didn't even want to bring it up. Someone prompted him to bring it up. And as soon as he did, I think after an initial eye roll by everybody started thinking about it. And like, well, what? This could be interesting. And what if we brought this mysterious figure around in the subplots, and you don't know who he is, but he somehow knows about Peter Parker's life, and it just is this build-up. And by the end of the first day, it was a really long, long day. by the first day, everybody was thrilled, excited. Now, the one person who wasn't at that meeting was Tom DeFalco, who at the time was the editor-in-chief and not a Spider-Man writer. So we had no writer for Spectacular Spider-Man at the moment. That was the one book that had the empty slot. So Danny, I remember, was also somewhat uncomfortable, just the radical nature of it. So he said, let's bring Tom to the next one, and he figured Tom is just going to shoot the whole thing down. And that was originally, I believe, why Tom was there. But by the end of the meeting, I remember, as I recall, what really was the turning point for us, you know, saying, okay, we're going to roll the dice, we're going all in on this, was Tom DeFalco realizing, after saying that, you know, there's no way, this doesn't work, the only way this doesn't work is because even if Peter Parker finds out he's a clown, after all this stuff, Ben Reilly's the real guy, Peter Parker's the clown, even finding out he's a clone, he would not retire from being Spider-Man because he had that sense of responsibility. Unless, and I seem to recall Howard Mackey literally jumping in his chair because he knew what was coming, and he said, come on, Tom, say it. And Tom says, unless, you know, Mary Jane's pregnant and he's got to become a father. And I think the room actually erupted in cheers because it's like, this was the answer. This was our story arc. And that was, and I know a lot of, I don't want to speak for anybody, I'm not speaking for anybody but my own memories, but I can tell you unequivocally in my memory, at least from that first conference, that was going to be the ending. I think some of the writers there have said that, you know, they always had in mind a back door where they could undo the story. They probably did. But I can assure you that that was the ending that was planned at the in the beginning.
It's pretty ballsy.
It was. And it was so ballsy that we came back and we had to start telling the marketing people, but we couldn't tell them much of anything. Because it was such a, if it leaked out, it would ruin the whole thing. So it was just something that we had to play very good. We had to keep it secret until, you know, it was time to stop playing it close to the vest and let the marketing people in on it to help us. And it was, I remember it really was like a ridiculous Pentagon level of security on this thing. Even between, we weren't allowed to tell fellow editors, I don't know if Glenn Greenberg remembers this, but he was not on the Spider-Man team yet, and he and I were already good friends, and I think we were eating, like, going out for a drink that night after the conference, and I said, okay, I really can't tell you what we're doing yet, but give me a few days. and that, you know, the rest is kind of history. And to get back to your actual question, which is what do I think about it, I think there was a lot of good work done during that time. I think Amazing Spider-Man 400 was an amazing, no pun intended, an Amazing Spider-Man 400 was a landmark. I kind of wish they hadn't undone the death of Aunt May, but that's just me. And some interesting characters came out of it. I thought Kane ended up being an interesting character. I thought that, and just skipping ahead, I thought it went on too long, and as many people did. The idea was to end the story in Amazing Spider-Man 400. But when the story really started getting legs and people were really getting interested, whether it was, you know, as you know, I mean, some people loved it, some people hated it, but everybody was talking about it, and lots of people were buying, more people were buying Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm.
All four of the books, because tying the four books together, which was, again, something we kind of got from the Superman people over at DC, that was successful for us as well. But then as it became an event, more an event and not just a storyline, it kind of became out of our hands editorially as to when we could end it. There was pressure that we keep it going. There was pressure to keep Ben Reilly around. And then when there was I'm probably getting ahead of myself, but the ending, when Bob Harris became editor-in-chief, there was a whole shift, and the pressure was opposite. The pressure was, we have to figure out a way to end this because it's gone on too long, and we want to get back to basic Spider-Man. The only question was how we would do that.
Now, I've had, obviously, conversations with Glenn about this period as well. And one thing I remarked to him, and that I think was successful, is that he was saying that, you know, when Onslaught was happening, you guys couldn't end the Clone Saga. You were about to end it. And they're like, no, you got to wait till after Onslaught. And that, you know, the basic ethos of the group was like, okay, we're going to tell the best Ben Reilly stories ever to make you love this character, because we know we're going to kill him off now. What's interesting to me at the time is that the minute the Clone Saga ends, Marvel doesn't mention the word clone for years. Even when they have clone characters, they go out of their way to use other words and other synonyms to not say clone, because it was so pervasive, this idea that you weren't going to talk about it anymore. Like, it was very, there was a very brief period in the post-Clone Saga, pre-relaunch Spider-Man books where there was a few references here and there, and then they just stopped. And it was probably, I don't know, 10, 12 years before anyone ever mentioned the word clone in a Spider-Man book, especially. Do you think that was a very drastic overcorrection, or do you think that was a natural, because they wanted to distance themselves from something that had become infamous, even though it started out with a very strong ideas and strong sales? Do you think that, like, that they overcorrected?
I heard this discussion that you and Glenn had, actually, and like him, I can't say that I actually noticed it at the time. But as with all the evidence you're presenting me, then I would have to agree that it probably was an overcorrection. By the time the Clone Saga ended, I was actually out of the Spider-Man office. I was concerned. You'll notice, if you remember, my credit on that was consulting editor. Because I was literally, like, editing my own books at the time, but came on board, again, as the guy who'd been there from the beginning to help Ralph and his team and Glenn and Tom Brevoort to kind of get everything together. So yeah, I guess I didn't notice it. I didn't have any clones in my Heroes for Hire or Quicksilver or any of my other books, but I'm sure in the X-Men book, there's always clones in the X-Men books, for example, and they probably didn't want to use it because.
That's actually the one I remember, is that they had Joseph, a clone of Magneto, but they never specifically called him that until like a decade or two later. And then they're like, oh, he's the clone of Magneto. But at the time, they used a lot of other language because they just did not want to say it.
Yes. Yeah. Language. Languages can be important.
So a random question I have, and getting away from, I will probably come back to clones, but I'll change the subject for a moment, just because you worked, I believe you worked on a book that I've never seen, but I know the character, and so I'm just curious about the process of coloring this book. You worked on Combo Man.
Combo, oh my God. Yeah, you know, I had... I do not remember that one. Yes, I worked on a few custom comics, actually. Combo Man. Did I call it? I guess I did. I guess I called it that.
I mean, Marvel fandom is not always correct, but usually it's correct, and it does show that you were the one who did the colors on this book. And like, I'm in Canada, I don't think we ever got it in Canada. Like, I remember obviously seeing the ad, because it's a very famous ad of, you know, the composite of all these different superhero characters. But I'm just curious, like, what was it actually like to work on this book? And as I said, I guess it is one of those kind of custom books, which I guess Marvel did more of them at the time than I maybe remember. So do you remember anything specific, or is it just kind of this mushy memory?
Well, about Combo Man, I remember nothing but the character's visual. Honestly, I think he had like Cyclops' visor and somebody's cape, and there was like a Hulk. There was a part of a Hulk on him or something. Yeah, I remember it was kind of an interesting vision. The idea, I mean, if you're going to do Combo Man, why not, right? It's reminding me a little bit of like, well, this is kind of a super scroll, right? But just a good guy.
He does kind of look like a colorist nightmare, though, because you combine so many different colors that don't really go together at all, and then in this weird hodgepodge. Yeah. That's why I'm more curious about it, because from a colorist perspective, it just doesn't look like tonally it would work. It looks like it would be a nightmare.
I'm sure it was, but I think those comics were usually like not full length. I think it might have just been an 8-page comic, so it probably wasn't as much of a headache.
Okay.
Plus, I think for custom comics, the thing with custom comics was, you know what I mean by custom comics, right? The ones that we license with other companies. There was no royalties involved. So to make up for the no royalties, they paid, I think, double the page rate for the creative team. So if it was a headache, the color, at least I got paid twice what I would normally. Didn't mind that one. That wasn't even the strangest custom comic I worked on, actually.
And what would that be?
There was a series that we did with Peter Pan Peanut Butter. And again, the people, like, I don't remember. God, I wish I could remember who wrote them. But there was like four artists who drew them. I think Alex Savvy might have even drawn one of them. And I felt bad for those guys because what they literally were these little 10, 12 page comics, but they had to fit inside the lid of a Peter Pan peanut butter jar.
Oh.
So they were round. They were like bound at this one corner and they were round. These little round pages. And we had to like tell a story in these 12 pages that somehow involved Peter Pan peanut butter. And actually, you know what? I'm an idiot. I wrote them.
Oh, did you?
I wrote and colored them. Yes. Yeah, now I remember. I couldn't get anybody else to do it. So there was the peanut butter ones, and there was a comic that teamed up Spider-Man. It was when the Florida Marlins, they were still the Florida Marlins, the baseball team in Miami, partnered with Marvel to do this special comic. There would be a giveaway where Spider-Man teamed up with their mascot, Billy the Marlin, who was, you know, this big walking fish character with a water gun. And I don't know if you've ever spoken to Glenn Herdling.
No, I haven't.
He is the guy who actually edited these custom comics for a long time. And a lot of the initial ideas came from him. And he brought me up to his office and said, okay, I got something. If you want something to write, I got something for you. It's Spider-Man, Billy the Marlin. They have to fight Dr. Doom. I guess the baseball team wanted Dr. Doom in the comic. So we need Spider-Man and Billy the Marlin versus Dr. Doom. And the scenario we came up with is Dr. Doom wants Jeff Conine, a player who I'm sure is long retired, but was a star for the Marlins. He wants to kidnap Jeff Conine to be on his Latverian All-Star team. So it was the most outrageous of ideas. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to run with this. And it was Billy the Marlin firing at Dr. Doom with his giant water pistol. And somehow the mascot and Spider-Man overcame Dr. Doom. And it was just, some guy in recent years found me on Instagram and had a copy of that. And he actually wanted the autographs of everyone who worked on that book.
That's amazing.
Around. Yeah. That one I know, that one Alex Saviak did draw. I remember that one. But yeah, I did the radio coloring on that one. So yeah, fun times.
Now, obviously, as you said, you did a lot of coloring here and there, and didn't necessarily have a steady coloring gig, but there were a bunch where you did, I know you did a number of issues of Web Spinners, that you did a bunch of the colors there. I'm curious, so in particular, you did a two-issue arc that Ron Frenz did, and Ron Frenz is a good friend of this show, with, I think, Bob McLeod did the pencils on him. What was the work like kind of coloring over Ron? Because, like, Ron's a pretty classic artist. Very classic style. If you were reading comics in the early 80s, like you said you were, like, I guess you probably would have seen a lot of Ron's stuff back then. And obviously he was still around. So what was it like to be able to color his work on Spider-Man? And also, you know, in that particular story, you get to color the black costume Spider-Man. As someone who wasn't a full-time colorist, how did you find it challenging dealing with the black costume and how it looks on the page?
I didn't find the black costume particularly challenging. Again, this is my dim memory of it. Because there's so, well, mainly because Ron is so good and Bob McLeod. And I'm not sure those guys had ever worked together before that. But I thought the combination was fantastic. They're both great guys. And Ron, I actually knew from before Marvel because we're both from Western PA. And he's from Pittsburgh, I think. And I met him a few times at conventions and stuff. So it was so amazing to finally work, you know, do coloring on his stuff. But I had a look up at put that in your note. I'm like, yeah, Web Spinner. This was the one that had like the Sinister Syndicate in it, right? With the Beetle and Boom, all these great, all these really colorful costumes that were really fun to work on. Like at the time, I was a pretty accomplished colorist, so I was really digging into things like, you know, making the Beetle's armor, you know, kind of put some highlights and shadows on that. I love like coloring metal armor characters. And like the Rhino, and trying to do something with that gray, like gritty hide and everything. Mm-hmm. So it was really fun. And I was thinking about this because you'd also mentioned Osborne Journal, which is such a different type of coloring. So I'd probably done that right around the same time, probably a little bit earlier. And they both were so much fun in their own way, because the stuff that Kyle Hoetz drew, and with almost horrific kind of art that I could do, like a lot of shadows and muted tones and everything. And then you get Ron Frenz and Bob McLeod and Spider-Man fighting six villains, and they all have colorful costumes, and it was just, that was fun in its own way. So yeah, that's where coloring and like kind of jumping around and being a jack of all trades, you know, keeps things interesting, because you're not kind of stuck in one genre, one palette.
At that time, obviously, you know, you have the coloring revolution that's occurring in the mid-90s, right? Because you have Malibu, you have places like Liquid coming out where have a very different, you know, and everyone's kind of going digital. When you were coloring at that time, were you starting to use digital tools, or were you staying old school?
It's funny. I was always old school. I did everything that I did on printed color guides, with either markers or dyes. I mean, I was more of a markers person because I was more of a drawer than a painter. So, I did everything old school, and I was just about to make the dive into the digital. It's about a year after we had the big layoffs in 98. That's when I left staff. And after that is when I got a lot of coloring work after that. I kind of stayed around and did a lot of work for Tom Brevoort, a lot of work for Ralph Macchio and some others. And about a year into that, a little more, I had to make a decision. It's like, okay, well, I want to keep just doing this for a living, or do I want to, you know, move on to my other love, which was getting into men's magazines, editor. Because I by that point I had become an editor by trade, basically. Mm-hmm. So did I want to keep being an editor and do different things, or do I want to keep coloring? And I eventually had a good job offer to jump into a men's magazine and be an editor. So yeah, I kind of left that behind. I still did a few old school coloring jobs after that, but I never, I never became one of those guys. Like my friend Kevin Tinsley became really good at that, and Joe Rosas, who colored a lot of the books I edited, and there's so many, and I don't know. I like to think I would have been good at it, but I never really explored it.
Mm-hmm. You brought up the Osborne Journal, which is obviously one of my favorite, you know, books of all time. It really spoke to me as a young reader at the exact right time. It was kind of everything I needed. I loved continuity. I loved, you know, understanding the world. That was obviously kind of an info dump, but done so well by Glenn. And so I never felt that it was that. I always thought it was just this amazing piece. And obviously you did the colors there. So I'm just curious, and you spoke to this a little bit, but obviously it's a very different, you know, overall... what's the word, like mood to the colors here, because you do have Kyle doing the art and it's very kind of creepy and dark, as opposed to, you know, the traditional lightness that you would see in a Spider-Man book. Did you find it really engaging to be able to kind of play outside what would have been kind of the typical Marvel comic color palette? Because it looks very unique compared to most books that they were on the shelves at that time.
Well, thank you for that. I did try to. I mean, all I can say is that I got these pages, and I just it still was probably one of the most joyful jobs that I've had as a colorist. I just think as soon as I saw them, I knew what needed to be there. I knew the palette that needed to be there that would complement all these great shadows and dark areas and textures that Kyle would put there, and if there was anything that I had in mind, I guess I'd have to admit it was because Kyle's style reminded me a bit of Kelly Jones's style, who was drawing Batman at the time, which was one of my favorite runs of anything. And I probably was influenced by how Greg Wright colored over Kelly Jones in the Batman books, because that was a really interesting palette. And whoever did the separations, I don't know if it was Malibu or whatever, but they did a fantastic job. So yeah, I just happy with that one all around.
Now, I'm curious in general, just because I haven't talked to many colorists who've done Norman Osborn, but is it a pain doing that hair?
I'm guessing it's probably a pain more for the penciler or inker to do that hair. No, I just got to, it's just kind of a auburn color, I guess. Much like the Spider-Man black costume, it's mostly filled in, most part, unless there's an artist that just leaves it open. But I didn't have a particular issue with Norman's hair. I still never seen anyone in real life with hair like that.
No, I guess
but
not.
Then again, J. Jonah Jameson has Hitler's mustache, and no one in real life has that either these days. So,
no, that's true. Now, when you start writing more, so obviously, I mentioned this to Glenn as well, but you were the writer on 101 Ways to End the Clone Saga, which is obviously a very fun, tongue-in-cheek one-shot. What was it like for you to be able to write that? Did it feel cathartic? Or, like, what was it like to do that experience?
Yeah, well, cathartic's a good word, actually. That was actually probably my first full-length writing assignment, and without going over too much old ground that you and Glenn had already gone over with the Osborn Journal, yes, the 101 Ways to End the Clone Saga started life as a budget buster, end of the year line one shot that no one knew what to do with. As I recall, it wasn't even an editorial person that put it on the schedule; it was a marketing person. When we got around to what are we going to do with this? What was literally on there was 101 uses for a dead clone. And I remember this being bandied about when the guys on the sales and marketing knew we were ending the Clone Saga, and it was like, oh, we should do 101 uses for a dead clone. And it was just this kind of joke, and somebody decided it should be on schedule. And then, they tell Ralph Macchio, okay, we really didn't do this. And he's like, Mark, you want to do? I forget how it came about, but it was me. But you want to write this? And I told, and I think I said, what I remember is that I don't want to do this. I don't want to do 101 uses for a dead clone. And the reason is for what you mentioned before, is that we were going full tilt to make Ben Reilly this character that people were going to love and people were going to miss, and his death is going to affect people. And then we're going to put out this flippant, really cruel kind of thing that I think would be an insult to the fans that loved this character. And he agreed with me, and I said, well, what if we have to do this one shot and it has to be kind of a satirical thing, we have all this material just sitting around, and I remember Greenberg, he kept all of these memos. He may still have them. He may still have them for all I know. All these rejected ideas for how to end the Clone Saga. Once we knew we were going to end it, I'm like, some of these are so outrageous. We should just do these. We should just do the story of how we came up with the ending, and put us into the book. Like, that's a great Marvel tradition. Stan and Jack put themselves in the book sometimes, and Dee Gerber and Byrne and all these guys did that. So why don't we do it this way, and it can still be funny, but it can be kind of true. So I went with that, and every scenario in that book, none of them are totally from my own head. I mean, the words, the dialogue, the way it played out. But these were all legit ideas. Some of them I thought even weren't that bad ideas, but I played all of them kind of for laughs. And then there's a little bit with Norman Osborn. We all take Norman Osborn at the end. That's the ending. Looking back on it, it was really, really fun. I think there was a little too much dialogue. I felt bad for the letterer. There kind of had to be a lot of dialogue. Ben Herrera, I thought, did a nice job. In fact, he worked, when I was the editor of Marvel Adventures, this animation-style book, I tapped him to do a lot of those because he was really good at that style. And, it was literally, there was almost nothing made up, per se, in that book. Even the scene in the diner, if you remember, Ralph and I, and I forget who else was in the scene, but that was a real diner that we used to go to for plot lunches and things like that, and even the guy who served us was based on this real old kind of crotchety Greek guy that used to serve us. So there was a lot of in-jokey stuff in there that most people would not get, but I hope that it was enjoyable enough for those that were on the outside.
I always enjoyed it. It was a fun book, and again, it was around the same time as The Osborne Journal. You could not have a more different book, obviously. One is very serious, very heady, and the other one is a lot more fun, but I always enjoyed it. So I do appreciate your work on that.
Thank you so much.
Now, again, early in this kind of, you're starting to transition into writing different assignments that come up. I'm curious how, you get two issues of Spectacular Spider-Man, you get a few issues of Spider-Man Unlimited. So what was it like to kind of, you've been working in the editorial office, you've been working in and around Spider-Man, you've colored Spider-Man, but now you're actually writing Spider-Man. Was that a big leap for you to be able to take? I mean, it was one thing to be doing a one-shot about Spider-Man, but now you're actually putting words in Peter Parker's mouth. What was that like?
Yeah. Well, it was a big leap for me as far as, being able to do it and, people trusting me to do it. The Spidey Unlimited stories, I'm still actually immensely proud of, especially because they're... I went right from doing a regular 22, 24-page one-shot to doing Unlimited, which I think was like 38 pages, so it wasn't even like a normal-sized comic, so it was a lot more plotting, a lot more scripting. I found it to be challenging, but also very, very satisfying. The Spectacular issues, that was my scripting over Mark DeMatteis's plotting. And that was a little intimidating because Mark DeMatteis was one of my favorite writers growing up. He was one of, he was one of our stable of great Spider-Man writers during the Clone Saga. And then I hired him to do the Man-Thing series in my office. And that was, I think he and I and Liam Sharp, I think we still consider that one of the finest things we ever did. So just to work over his plot was really challenging, but I think it came out pretty well. He also does a lot of really good dialogue cues in his plot, so I knew he's really good at projecting not only what's going on but what the characters are thinking. So for a guy scripting from his plot, it's really helpful. It's like, I know I'm not in conflict with any kind of dialogue that he would have put there. So, and again, just to go back to where I started, like as a kid who loved Spider-Man, writing Spider-Man was just a dream come true. And as writing Spider-Man's dialogue, I don't know if this is, don't mean this to come across as conceited or anything, but it came easier to me than I thought. Maybe just from reading him and watching all this time, I kind of really took to the kind of wisecracky dialogue. And again, maybe a few too many word balloons, and some of those are the ones, but because of that. But the patter, I'd write a line for Spider-Man, and I'm like, Spider-Man would say that.
So in and around this period, what I find is interesting, because there's such a gap between them, is that you did two different issues of X-Men, but like 17 issues apart. So like, I'm curious how you got parachuted in to like, and was it just that? Was it like, we have a spot, we have a gap between writers, or we just have a spot? Like, how did that come about? And it's just interesting to me that it happened twice.
Yeah. Yeah, under under two different, you've done your homework, really. Under two different editors, actually. Two totally different circumstances.
Well, because Glenn edited one of them, didn't he?
Glenn edited the second one, which I believe was X-Men of 48.
You are correct, yes.
And the first one was edited by Jay Gardner, who was actually my office mate when I was an associate editor. Jay did X-Men books, and I did my own little quirky series of books with Man-Thing and Heroes for Hire and such. And so we just knew what each other was doing all the time, and Jay was having trouble with his regular writer or his regular artist or both, I don't remember. So he was urged to get a fill-in issue done, and he asked me to do it. And I'm like, and I'll be honest, to this day, I really don't know much of anything about X-Men. It was really a hard character to write because I just don't know if he was ever really that defined as a character. I'm not doing that to insult anyone who worked on him. I didn't really read it. I had to be briefed on kind of what he was supposed to be acting like, what's supposed to be driving him. So with that in mind, I decided, well, if I'm going to do this, I'm not going to do anything like, and I thought I probably wasn't even allowed under Jay to play around in the big overall mutant universe thing, because X-Men, as you probably know, is all tied in with time travel and Cable and alternate realities and all this stuff, and his powers are just undefined but just crazy, like just can do anything from I couldn't tell you really what his powers are except mental stuff. So I decided, well, if I'm gonna do, I'll do something fun that has nothing really to do with the overall universe but brings back a mutant character from one of my childhood favorite series, which was ROM Space Knight. And nobody could have a problem with me digging up an old villain from ROM Space Knight and and using that instead of, you know, and like not stepping on anyone's toes on the X-Men universe. So I was really, really extraordinarily happy with that story, just the fact that they let me do it. And I think I was able to add some nuance to a character that was probably long forgotten. And I tried writing, at the time, X-Files was a big show, and I tried writing it kind of like an X-Files episode, where you'd start out with this mysterious tragedy, and you track down, like, what's wrong with this child, and why does he have this power, and so I thought that all came together very well. And then later on, Glenn Greenberg got the X-Men title. I won't speak for him, but I'm not sure that he ever, I don't know if he could tell you, you know, that much about, you know, what his take on X-Men was, but he also had, you know, kind of an issue whether it was deadlines or just, you know, creative gridlock or whatever, he needed an issue done, and so he gave me this opportunity to write one, and I was like, okay, and once again, it was one of these things where I don't want to end up in some huge X-Men crossover thing or stepping on anyone's toes. So this time, I remembered an old Thor villain that showed up once back in the 1980s and used that, because at the time, there was the overall arc for Nate at the time, Nate being X-Men, was that there was people who were starting to see him as some kind of messianic figure. Mm-hmm. And I don't know where ultimately that went, but I figured, okay, there was a villain who was convinced that he was a holy warrior, that he was, you know, powered by heaven and he was a holy warrior, and he would be offended by this. So, you know, that was kind of the setup. He was, you know, in a monastery, like, trying to recover from his mental illness, and all of a sudden he finds out about this Nate Gray, this blasphemer, and he seeks him out, and we have this fun battle in London, and kind of touch on some themes of belief and faith and all that stuff. So yeah, two very different stories for two different editors, same character. Years later, Glenn and I were just talking about comics in general. And I thought, you know, and I said, you know, if you had given me X-Man to write regularly, I guess maybe I would have really, really dug my teeth into it and tried to do something different. So I don't know. Who knows? I might have been able to do some stuff with X-Man, but...
I'm curious.
We got what we got.
So even just so you do that second book for Glenn, and then you're back 6 issues later, but you're coloring it. Is that weird to be like, I was writing this book, now I'm coloring the book? Like, because you are wearing so many hats, maybe it's not. Maybe you're just so used to kind of gliding back and forth. But it just seems interesting that you would have, you know, within 6 months work on the same book, but in two very different capacities.
Yeah, it wasn't that strange for me, just because I had written and colored books in the past. Most of them were these custom comics, it wasn't unheard of for me, and it also just because I had colored so many different things. Like you said, I actually did get a couple of regular. I did get a couple of regular gigs, like, you know, post editor job when I was a freelancer. But at the time, yeah, it was a lot of spot work. It was a lot of rush work. So I colored like almost everybody. So none of it was. I mean, if you're asking me if I'm coloring the pages and thinking, boy, I would have rather written a different bit of dialogue here. Maybe sometimes like that. As a writer, you're always probably doing that.
So a book that I found listed somewhere that you did, maybe that you're at least credited as being one of the pencilers, and I'm just curious if this is true, is in the Heroes Reborn Rebel one-shot. Did you contribute pencils to this book?
Heroes Reborn. I definitely never penciled an issue of anything, but... Heroes Reborn, can you tell me who the team was on that?
So it looks like it was Joe Kelly and Matt Haley. And it was just a one-shot, and it was like, you know, late 99.
I think that's probably a mistake. the one credit I have as an illustrator beyond being a colorist is I did do sketches for a lot of covers. For both the Spider-Man office and for some of my own books. And at one point, I think it was Pat Broderick was the penciler, actually credited me on, it was just this really, really simple sketch that he made, that he penciled the cover, somebody inked it. I think he put after Bernardo in the corner or something. So yeah, no actual penciling. I did a few other, I did do a few uncredited logo designs back for Innovation Comics back when I was there. But again, a little bit of jack of all trades there. Never penciled anything.
Okay. Now the last, I guess, specific Marvel question I have before I will hopefully let you get back to your evening in a couple minutes is you did write one of my favorite Scorpion stories in Spider-Man Unlimited 22. So I'm just curious what it was like to kind of end that book. Like, did you know that you were the last story to go on in Spider-Man Unlimited and kind of bring that book to its close? And irrespective of that, what was it like to be able to write a classic Lee Ditko character in Scorpion?
First of all, thank you for that. I did know that it was the last issue of Spider-Man Unlimited. And if you'll indulge me for a few minutes, remember there's a lot of stuff was in that story. We had Black Tarantula.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. So, Ralph Macchio told me, okay, we got one more issue with Spider-Man Unlimited. You want to write it? What do you want to do? I always wanted to do the Scorpion, one of my favorite Spidey villains. And he said, okay, sure. But what you also have to do, we have this Black Tarantula character, Tom DeFalco introduced.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of lost track of him, and we want to do something to, like, you know, resolve this character too. And I can make that work. And then what I wanted to do, and a little information about Ralph, the Roxxon Oil Corporation is this institution in Marvel. This quintessential evil Marvel corporation. They employed supervillains, they created supervillains, they tried to mine the Savage Land, they've done all this stuff. And Ralph is a huge, huge fan of Roxxon Oil. He's used them in many, many stories, and his mandate was always, they got to get away with it. This is our message. It's an evil corporation. The villains get caught, but Roxxon gets away with it. And I'm like, Ralph, this is the last issue of this series. You want it to be important. I want Roxxon to finally get nailed. And he said, we started negotiating it. So what he let me do, okay, so you remember the story, and I said that Roxxon kind of souped up the Scorpion, made him out to be some kind of hero. Black Tarantula was employed by them. They had this supervillain training camp down in South America or something, I believe it was. And I brought back some character from Roger Stern's Amazing Spider-Man story about Roxxon years and years ago, and brought him into the story. And so I set up this whole scenario where Black Tarantula would get away, the camp would be destroyed, Scorpion would get defeated like usual, but Roxxon would finally get nailed with a RICO indictment. And as long as it was, I needed to have the line in there. Ralph, I couldn't actually put them out of business, but I could get them read their rights and indicted and in the papers as bad guys. So that was as far as we were to go. So I was just happy. I don't know what's happened since then, but that was the closest Roxxon Oil's ever got to be busted.
I love that it's a negotiation with the editor. It's like, please let me do this.
Oh yeah.
So, I'm curious, just in general, like, what, at that point in your career, having worked in editorial, then again, transitioning into writing at this point, like, what was your relationship with Ralph like at that point in time?
I consider my time with Ralph to be some of the most productive and creative editorial time that I've had. He was great to work for. He was a guy who just knew the characters. He knew what Spider-Man should be as far as, you know, what type of character. The same he did for the Avengers, and I mean, his pedigree is like, he ended Frank Miller on Daredevil and just a lot. He went way back, and he really, and at the same time, he appreciated, you know, my track record with Spider-Man, with more recent Spider-Man. So he deferred to me a lot when it came to just with creative teams and especially, like, I was the guy. Ralph was the guy with a writing background. I was more a guy with an artistic background. So he deferred to me on covers and logo colors and just things like that. So it was a really, really good synergy. The time. And basically from when Ralph took over to the end of the Clone Saga, when I was working really closely with Todd DeZago, Howard Mackey, I'm not sure if Donatus was still around at the time, but John Romita Jr., who's one of my favorite people ever to work with, Mike Waringo, the late Mike Waringo, Ralph and I got him and Todd together, and I just think those are some of my favorite Spider-Man books. I think, was it Web or Sensational that they did? Those
Sensational.
Issues with Swarm.
Yeah,
those two issues with Swarm, I thought, were maybe a high point of that era. Mm-hmm. And I thought the whole Revelation saga also came together really nicely.
It's going back to Unlimited for a second. So, like, your first two issues of Unlimited, so one of them you have the Dread Knight, who's a fun character, which I don't think he'd been used much at that point, so it was kind of nice to see him again. So you had Joe Bennett, the first two issues you wrote of Spider-Man Unlimited, and then between that and coming back for issue 22, Mike Diodato Jr. was the regular artist for, I think, two or three issues. Did you find that you... Like, did you, first of all, I guess, because they were semi-regular in the book, did you in any way tailor the way that you plotted for your artist in this instance? And then obviously this would have been part of the kind of the learning process of you as a writer, is to kind of, were you writing it to their strengths or just writing the story? And my favorite example of this is always Steve Englehart, when he was telling me about, you know, when he wrote for, when he was still working with, oh my God, now I forget his name, Marshall,
Marshall Rogers.
And he was saying that their first collaborations, he didn't know who the artist was going to be, but he was about to go on vacation to Europe, so he did like an airtight plot so that no one could screw it up and anyone could make it look good. So were you of that school, or were you more like, no, I got Joe, I know what he does, I know his big, bold action, I can do the story like this? Or was it neither of those?
That's a good question. I don't know if I can say I tailored the plot to specific artists. I can say that I love doing the Marvel style, you know, which is plot first, then let the artist, you know, do his thing, and then script. I'm told now that Marvel does full plot script before the artist gets it now. I don't know if I'd enjoy doing it that way, just because I grew up with, you know, the Marvel style and kind of letting... I liked letting the artist, giving the artist some leeway as far as how to tell the story, because I knew that they were, and both Bennett and Diodato were just amazing, and I guess the I'm not sure that I knew Bennett was drawing the Dread Knight issue, the first one I did. I did know that he was doing the Lizard issue. And I think maybe by that point I was thinking a little bit more with playing to his strengths, like that splash page with the alligator I thought was really good. The Lizard story on it, it occurs to me, was actually one of my favorite things, and it's one of those things that, you know, up front when you're gone from Marvel, and it kind of frustrates you that it wasn't ever picked up on, was that I created this this rationale, and I will totally tip my cap and admit that what Peter David did with the Hulk totally kind of moved me in this direction with the Lizard, when we realized that the gamma rays aren't necessarily what created the Hulk persona. It was the fact that Banner had always been a split personality of a kind, and the gamma ray mutations kind of brought that out. And I thought that was the most brilliant thing that I'd read in a long time when I read it. And I figured, okay, maybe Kurt Connors is the same way, in that, you know, he was a veteran when they introduced him, and he lost his arm, but then, like, he gets this serum, and all of a sudden he turns into this monster who wants to, like, destroy humanity. And, like, well, why would that happen unless he had this id? And then I read about the reptilian brain, which is this real concept from science. I'm like, oh, this would be fun to put in there, that he always had this kind of reptilian brain inside that wanted revenge on humanity for maiming him. And I tried to get that across in there, I don't think anyone's ever really dealt with that sense, but it's there if anybody wants to.
They've definitely done a lot of crazy things with the Lizard in the last, I would say, 10 years or so. So not specifically in that direction, unfortunately. A question before I let you go about working on, again, issue 22 with the Scorpion. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, we get a new redesign of the Scorpion by Diodato. And because it's Diodato, I mean, and it's also in your script because he's supposed to be more heroic, but he looks like amazing and more jacked up than probably he's ever looked before. Given that you were such a huge fan of the Scorpion, did you like him looking that big? And this isn't a knock against the art at all. It's just a different interpretation of the character. How did you feel about seeing Scorpion in that way? Or did you think it just worked better for your story?
I think it worked perfectly for the story. I think the Scorpion being more kind of this... And again, I know that's Diodato's style. Diodato is another guy who I actually knew before Marvel. I never knew him in person, but we kind of discovered him when I was at Innovation before he made it big at Marvel. So I kind of knew what to expect with him. And the work's beautiful, and it just really has this larger than life kind of energy to it, and I think it worked very well for that story. And I mean, if he had made Spider-Man like overly look that way, I probably would have had more of a problem. But the Scorpion being jacked up, to use your term there, which is good, I think that worked wonders for that story, because that was what I was trying to get across. And again, I'm not sure people think as much about it unless you go back read that first Scorpion story by Leon Ditko, that he was supposed to be such a threat because he was everything Spider-Man was, but strong. He was the only foe that was created specifically to destroy Spider-Man. And thus, he should be, you know, really regarded as one of the biggest threats that Spider-Man could face. So I tried to, you know, the intimidation factor is what I tried to get across with that Spider-Man maybe has always been a little intimidated by this character because he was just so ruthless and so merciless, and you know, his whole reason for existing is to kill him. So I thought that Deodato's art got that across in a really creepy and, you know, significant way.
It's interesting. I always thought that, you know, Scorpion in his conception is supposed to kind of be what Venom ended up being, you know, bigger, stronger, faster, you know, and as you said, kind of designed to stop him. It always bugged me when it felt like some writers would write the Scorpion as kind of an also-ran, because I'm like, well, I don't think Jameson would, you know, hire to get this guy transformed wasn't going to be able to do the job. And it just felt like, you know, unfortunately, over time, that became more of an overriding aspect of the character. So, like your version felt a little bit more true to his roots.
Yeah, well, thanks. Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think your Venom comparison is one that I've made in the past. I think that he was kind of before his time as kind of a dark version of you know, a spider and a scorpion. Though the arachnid one is meaner than the other, so it was kind of that's also why I set that battle in that issue in this desert. Because it's like where a scorpion is the most dangerous. But I did try to have that symbolism in mind.
I unfortunately think it was lost on me, but I appreciate it now.
Okay, we'll read it again.
All right, I will. Well, again, Mark, thank you so much for taking the time today to go down memory lane with me and to talk about these books, because again, they mean a lot to me, and this period is so fascinating to me, this 90s comic book period, and you were there for so much of it, you know, working in editorial and in and around it. So I really value your insights and your stories, and actually, you know what, I just realized I forgot the most obvious thing I wanted to ask you, is that do you have a favorite Mark Gruenwald story?
A story Mark Gruenwald wrote, or a story about Mark?
About Mark Gruenwald. That's a good distinction to make, but about the man.
Oh, okay. Well, let's see. I'm not sure. So I went to Mark Gruenwald's bachelor party. Mark was such a friendly person, welcoming to new. I think I was literally 2 weeks or so on staff at Marvel. It was me and this guy, Mort Todd, who was another inventor there who did the Marvel music books. And yet he invited us to this crazy bachelor party, I believe it was at Larry Hama's apartment in New York. And I'm not sure what I'm allowed to even feel from that, but that's kind of, I remember that being just a really significant memory. There were so many. I guess I wasn't prepared to answer that one, but what I do remember, what I didn't say, is that Mark Gruenwald and Elliot Brown, I guess, used to do a public access cable show when they were young, when they were younger, and they reenacted it for this at this bachelor party, and then however it came about. At one point, Mark Gruenwald came out. He left the room, and he came out wrapped head to toe in cellophane. And I'll just leave it at that. And it was just something that it was some tribute to the public access show that they had once done. And it was an honor just to be there.
He was obviously, you know, this larger-than-life personality, very friendly and gregarious from all accounts I've ever heard and read. And obviously kind of, I think Glenn agreed with the idea that maybe he was the soul of Marvel at the time. What did you think was the biggest lesson you learned from him? Because I know that he was obviously this extremely important editor and what he kind of how he approached the job was definitely pervasive at the time in terms of, I think a lot of people had almost like editorial school with Mark, right? About kind of how to be a good editor at Marvel. So what do you think you kind of took away from him as this teacher?
Yeah. Well, it was literally that. I mean, we assisted editors every week, once a week, would go up to, I forget where we had it, it was either Mark's office or some boardroom or something. It was assistant editor school, and we talked about plotting, we talked about art, we just talked about pop culture. We kind of had a brainstorming session, like, what's big in pop culture now? But I guess the biggest thing that I learned from Mark Grunewald as far as being a story editor, the idea that every supporting character should be important. It's hard to explain. He explained it much better than I ever could, but I see this rule being broken all the time in not just comics, but all kinds of mediums. And Mark had it right. If you're going to do a supporting character, you're going to do a supporting cast for a character, they all need to play an important role to them. They have to have an important link to the main character. They can't just be there in the background. Something about them has to say something that defines the main character. And I think that is a lesson I always took to any kind of creative writing that I did. And I'm not sure it's being taught that much nowadays. Mm. And I think that's a storytelling wise that is the Mark Grunewald thing that sticks with me.
Excellent. Well, again, thank you so much for... I almost let you go, and then I made you stick around for a couple more minutes just to talk about Mark, but...
A few more steps down memory lane. Never hurt anybody.
Absolutely. Well, again, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it, and thanks for, so many insights into the Marvel of the 90s.
Yeah,